Right. It is good to be with you all tonight. Thankful for your presence and for your zeal to come and study the Word of God together. John, would you lead us in prayer as we begin?
Almighty, loving God and Father, thank you for this wonderful day you've given us. Thank you for this opportunity to come together to study your Word. We pray that you'd be with Justin as he leads us in this study, that he would remember the things he's prepared and do a great job of presenting them. We love you so much. We thank you for Christ and his sacrifice on the cross for our sins. We thank you for your Word, which shows us that story and teaches us what we need to do. We love you, and it's through Jesus we pray. Amen.
All right, so I made a couple of sheets available back there if you didn't get one. Just supplemental material to what we're going to talk about this evening. I need to make sure I emphasize that, because Sunday morning, I was saying Sunday evening the whole time. But tonight, we're going to look at Isaiah chapter 33 and 34. We'll get into both of in chapter 33 and begin chapter 34. We left off around verse 17 last time, and we noticed the kind of character, the kind of people who are able to come and dwell with God. People who walk in righteousness, who speak with sincerity, who reject unjust gain. They don't take a bribe. They stop their ears from hearing about evil. They shut their eyes from seeing bloodshed, those kind of things. And what we're going to find in verses 17 through 24 is the blessings that come from turning your life over to God, the blessings that stem from turning to God and honoring Him as the King. What we'll find is that these people are no longer going to run back and forth to the nations. They're not going to go to Egypt anymore, but they're going to put their trust and their confidence in God. And as they do that, they're going to find that security, that refuge that they've been looking for all along. Just kind of think about that for a moment. The reality is that we've all got to come to that decision in our lives. And we've got to make the choice, who am I going to give my honor to? Who is going to be the king of my life? Who is going to be the Lord and Master who rules my life? And we've seen the kind of despair, the kind of hopelessness of what happens when we crown ourselves as king from this book. Or when we go to foreign rulers or turn to other people. But the promise is that when we turn to God and give Him the preeminence and seek Him and honor Him as our King, that we can have that peace and security, not merely in physical terms. Maybe that's the case sometimes. But I think much more so spiritually. That we can have the peace and security with God for walking with Him and for honoring Him. We may not be delivered from all the trials and difficulties of this life, but God has promised to deliver us from our greatest problem of all, which is sin. And He's done that through His Son. So that's a really key idea of what we're going to see here. So let's go ahead and read Isaiah 33, verse 17 through 24. It says, "Your eyes will see the King in His beauty. They will behold a far distant land. Your hearts will meditate on terror. Where is He who counts? Where is He who weighs? Where is He who counts the towers? You will no longer see a fierce people, a people of unintelligible speech, which no one comprehends, of a stammering tongue which no one understands. Look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, an undisturbed habitation, a tent which will not be folded. Its stakes will never be pulled up, nor any of its cords be torn apart. But there, the majestic one, the Lord, will be for us a place of rivers and wide canals on which no boat with oars will go, and on which no mighty ship will pass. For the Lord is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. He will save us. Your tackle hangs slack. It cannot hold the base of the mast firmly, nor spread out the sail. Then the prey of an abundant spoil will be divided. The lame will take the plunder. And no resident will say, 'I am sick.' And the people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity. And so we see this thought from verse 16 continue on into verse 17, that those who dwell with God will see the King in His beauty. That same word, that same Hebrew word, is used in Psalm 45, which is a royal psalm, which talks about the King, speaks of the Lord as King, and that word is used there as the fairness of the King, the beauty of the King, the majesty of the King. They'll see Him. And they behold this far distant land. And this is looking into the future. And this land is described in verses 21 through 23 as a place of security, a place that there is no fear in the land compared to what they have seen before. And what we're told is in verse 18 that their heart will meditate on terror. When you read that, it kind of seems like a negative image, right? Meditating on terror, that doesn't sound like a very good thing. But I think the point here is that they're going to think back to this crisis that they're in, and they're going to meditate upon it. They're going to meditate on this terror that they had previously known. They'll be brought through this difficult time. And it's almost like they're on the other side, and they're looking back, and they're thinking about this terrible and horrible time that they're going through. And they meditate upon it. They think about it. They learn from it. They begin to realize that God is the one who brought them through. Let me ask you this. Whenever we go through difficult times, hardships, trials, difficulties, doesn't it seem like sometimes they are just unending? That they never, that it's almost like time stops. That you're never going to be able to get out of this. That this is going to keep going on forever and ever. I think the reality is, as we all know, that time does go on. And the people of Judah find themselves on the other side of this, and they're meditating upon this terror that they had previously known. They think about He who counts, He who weighs the tributary money, He who counts the fortification and towers of Judah. They think about that time when all of this was going on, when the Assyrians had come against them, and they're no longer going to see a fierce people. They won't have to deal with the unintelligible speech of the Assyrians. All of that is passed from them. And they're thinking back, they're thinking back upon this, they're meditating upon it. They're learning from the lessons that they have been through in this time, and they give thanks to God, I would imagine, for Him bringing them through that. And that's the point for us as well. That when we find ourselves on the other side of the trials and difficulties of life, is that when we can meditate upon them, and we can learn from those things that we have gone through, and they can be something that will help us with the next trial we encounter. But we can think about how God has got us through that, He has led us through that, and give praise and honor to Him. And I don't want to dismiss the trials and sufferings that we go through, but if there's anything we learn from this passage, is that they ultimately pass, and we can meditate back upon them. And I think that's what's going on here. You saw that idea in verse 19 of the unintelligible speech which no one comprehends. That is a contrast to what we saw back in Isaiah 28 in verse 11. Isaiah 28 verse 11, the Lord says, and He will speak to the people through stammering lips and a foreign tongue. That idea there. As it transitions from here, as they meditate on terror, instead of doing that, instead of seeing the fierce Assyrians, they're going to look upon Zion, the city of their appointed feast. And really, Zion is described in two ways in this passage. The first one is a picture of fellowship and worship of God, these appointed feasts. And the other picture that we see in verse 21, or verse 20, is a picture of peace and security. We find this tent imagery, and we'll come back to that. But think about this. Zion, or Jerusalem, was a place where God's people came together and worshiped Him. He mentions here that these feast days. Can you think about any of the important feasts for the people in Jerusalem during this time period? Pentecost, the Feast of Pentecost.
Passover,
the Passover feast. What else? There's a third one that's a pretty big one. Was that
Day of Atonement?
Day of Atonement? Yeah, that's. I mean, that is a pretty big thing for women. Feast of Booths. Yeah, Feast of Booths or Tabernacles.
That was just hadn't been good very long ago.
What did all those things represent? What was the purpose of remembering the Feast of Passover?
Remember what God did for them and brought them out of Egypt.
Exactly. And what about
took them out of that bondage and brought them into a new relationship?
Yes, exactly. What about the Feast of Tabernacles? Yeah, it represented the wilderness and the traveling. They would stay in these tents, I think for 7 weeks, I believe. It may have been a different time frame. And it was all to recall what God had done for them and how God had provided and shown His compassion and His concern for them. And that's kind of being what is called the mind here. That they're going to look upon Zion, the city of their appointed feasts, and they go back and they remember these times that they had. And in fact, this is a contrast to what we saw back in chapter 1 and verse 14. Turn back there for a moment with me. Isaiah 1 and verse 14. The Lord says something about their feasts here, but it's a different thing. It's a contrast. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 14. It says, I hate your new moon festivals and your appointed feasts. They become a burden to me, and I am weary of bearing them. And so we find this coming full circle again. That they are looking forward to these appointed feasts. But not only that, Jerusalem is described as an undisturbed habitation. And you can go back in chapter 32 and verse 18. It says, "And my people will live in a peaceful habitation, and in secure dwellings, and in undisturbed resting places." And that's what God promises them. I mean, you think about all that's going on right now, this Assyrian crisis, and it's not peaceful at all. That there is a lot of chaos and different things going on, but this is what God promises them if they will honor Him and give Him the preeminence as King in their life. And it mentions a very powerful passage here. A tent which will not be folded. Its stakes will never be pulled up, nor any of its cords be torn apart. What does that call to your mind? Of a tent that is not being pulled up anymore.
Permanent?
Permanency? What else?
Well, you can think of it too, like the temple or heaven.
Yeah, the tabernacle, God's dwelling place. And I think there's a couple of images in here that Isaiah may be tapping into. But the tabernacle in the wilderness. The tabernacle was God's dwelling place. It was where He could be met. Remember, God's presence was in the Holy of Holies, as John mentioned, that on the Day of the Atonement, the high priest could go in once a year and atone for the people's sin. That was where he was met, and God dwelled in that tabernacle. But during those wilderness wanderings, the tabernacle, and in one sense God, was continually moving with His people. They were going throughout the wilderness. His presence was like a cloud during the day, a pillar of fire by night, leading the people in the way that they needed to go. But here, it's a permanent position. It's a permanent thing. Their pilgrimage is over. And so it's a permanent rest with God. That may be one of the things He has in mind. And what a powerful passage about this is Hebrews chapter 12, which talks about the heavenly Zion. Hebrews chapter 12. Turn over there with me for a moment.
Did you say Hebrews?
Hebrews chapter 12. As the Hebrew writer makes a contrast between Mount Sinai and Zion. He says in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 22, it says, "But you have come to Mount Zion, into the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and the myriads of angels." And so there is in that sense that in heaven we will be with God and dwell with Him for all of eternity. And I think maybe this is pointing forward to that very thing. There's another passage in Revelation chapter 21 that uses the imagery of God dwelling with his people. And in Revelation 21, I'll read verses 1 through 3. Just listen to this and call this to your mind and see how this ties into all of this. It says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride, adorned for her husband. And a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them.'" This is a similar imagery to what we're seeing here in Isaiah chapter 33 and verse 20, this tent which will not be rooted up. That's a really powerful thing to think about, that one day we will be dwelling with God for all of eternity. We will be people who live by faith and follow him and give him priority and live faithfully to him. But I think there's another image that may be tapped into here of a traveler who has been able to settle permanently. You see this idea of people like Abraham, who was a sojourner. He was a pilgrim. He was always on the move. He never found a place to call home in this life. But the images of a sojourner, a pilgrim, of a traveler, an alien, who has found that fertile valley, that place that they were looking for, and they can put up their tent on a permanent basis. And I think it would do us well to remember that more often in this life. The fact is that we are sojourners. We're aliens. We're pilgrims. We have homes that we live in here, but this isn't our eternal home. We're constantly on the move. We are not at home. We are just passing through on our way home to heaven. And I think that's this may be what's tapping into. Think about Hebrews chapter 11, those heroes of faith who are awaiting a better country, a city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And that needs to be our attitude as well. Think about just Hebrews 11, verses 9 and 10, of what is said about Abraham. Hebrews 11, verse 9 and 10. "By faith, he lived as an alien in a land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God." And so, we await that better country where we can finally, as it were, have our tents pegged down forever. Any other thoughts on those two verses? Maybe see them in a different way, but any questions or comments on that?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it. I think as we read through this chapter and the ones to come, whatever, he's letting people know that God is the person who is in charge.
Exactly.
Definitely in charge. And I think with the states we go on in 37, he tells them that they will not shoot one arrow. There will not be an attack at all on Jerusalem.
Yeah.
You will be protected. My hand is protecting it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing for us today. It doesn't matter what kind of hardships come to us or what's happening. If we follow and stay right with God, he will his hand will protect us. That's what I take from
it. Good point. Yeah, absolutely. Any other thoughts on that tent imagery or security there? Does that make sense, what I was trying to get across? So we're told in verse 21, "But there the majestic one, the Lord, will be for us a place of rivers and wide canals, on which no boat with oars will go, and which no mighty ship will pass." One of the things about Jerusalem is that they didn't have a river that contributed to their defense. Babylon had the Euphrates River that would serve as a source of defense for them. Nineveh had the Tigris River that served as a defense for them. But Jerusalem didn't have any of that. And really, rivers would have been, again, a source of protection from the enemy. It would have been pretty difficult to cross a river, taking time at least. But also, having a river made a city vulnerable to attack, a naval attack. And I think what Isaiah is saying here, going on with, along with Johnny's comment, is that this is used symbolically to show that Judah is going to have protection. God is going to be the one who protects her. And they're not going to have to worry about an enemy coming in and invading them. God will fight for her. And so they express their confidence in God in three ways in verse 22. That the Lord is our judge. He is our lawgiver. And he is our king. You think about this. God is their judge in the sense of the book of Judges. That he is their champion and their defender. He is their lawgiver. One of the things in the ancient Near East culture was that kings all across the ancient Near East claimed that they were people who were able to give law or to provide law. Now, there is a law code called Hammurabi's Law Code. It was a Babylonian law code. And there was an 18th century BC prologue to Hammurabi's Law Code, which says that he was appointed to cause justice to prevail in the land so the strong might not oppress the weak. And all across the ancient Near East, that's what kings claimed, that they were the lawgivers. But God, what we find here is God is the ultimate lawgiver. He is the source of justice. He deals with righteousness. He is fair in all of his dealings. He is that lawgiver. And he is the king that will be able to deliver and save his people. And one of the interesting things here to me is that all of these things could be used of Christ as well. That he is judge. John 5 and verse 22. The Father has given all judgment to the Son. He's the lawgiver. In essence, that he's ushered in this new covenant through his blood. This new law that we're under today. Hebrews chapter 1 verses 1 and 2. Shows that God speaks through his Son today. And then he's the king, Revelation 17 and verse 14. That he is Lord of lords and King of kings. Hello?
Well, of course, it's through branches of government too. The Lord is our lawgiver, makes the laws. The judge who executes the law, make sure that the justice is served. And the king who can give pardon when he sees that these things, there's an extenuating circumstances and grace needs to be involved.
Yeah, that's a good point too. And I think this is kind of a capstone to what's been going on here. The question for the people of Israel, or the people of Judah, was, are they able to trust God, that he will be able to deliver them and rescue them from their enemies? We find them, again, going to Egypt for help and protection. That fails them. But here they're coming full circle and recognizing that, yes, the only one who is able to save us is God, the true king. That we are hopeless on our own. God alone is the one who is able to save us. And they come to that realization here. Verse 23 is kind of interesting, right? It's kind of abrupt. He goes from all of this great hope and great imagery here. And then he says, "Your tackle hangs slack and cannot hold the base of its mast firmly, nor spread out the sail. Then the prey of an abundant spoil will be divided." That's kind of an interesting turn right there, isn't it? I don't know. Anybody here know much about ships or boats in that kind of imagery? Any seafarers in here? No? Me neither. So, but the picture here is a ship that's in disarray. That its tackle or its ropes or slack doesn't hold up the mast of the boat. The sail isn't able to spread out. It's kind of just floating. And there's been kind of two views as to who this is referring to. Some people think it's the Assyrians. That the Assyrians are like this ship that is in disarray that's about to be plundered by God's people. The spoil is going to be divided. Even the land will take the plunder. And that very well could be what's regarded here. Some think that maybe this is referring to the nation of Judah. And the point being that the only reason that they have any hope of triumph over their enemies, the only reason that they have any hope of a bright future ahead of them, is not because there's some kind of mighty ship that is able to run over their enemies. Because really, they're just a ship that's in disarray. It's kind of just floating. The only hope that they have, the real hope that they have, is by turning back to God, who is able to provide this hope, this conquering of the enemy. And it's only when they realize their dependence upon God that they're able to take the spoil and plunder the enemy. I hope that makes sense. Both of those things may be able to fit. I would probably go with Assyria being talked about here. But both of those are options. Yes?
Well, the important thing that's missing in this boat, it's got the tackle, it's got the mast, it's got the sail.
There's no wind.
Yeah.
You know, the invisible force.
Yeah.
That moves it forward.
Yeah.
You may think you're real smart, can build something really great.
Yeah.
But if you don't have any wind, you're not going to.
Yeah, that's a really good illustration. I like that a lot. And that was, I think that's what maybe Isaiah is trying to get across to the people of Israel, the people of Judah, is that just because you're going to, the enemy will be overcome, it doesn't mean that you're so great. But it's because of the one who is behind you and who fights for you. That's a great point. Any other thoughts or comments on this? All right, verse 24, this section ends by saying, "No resident will say, I am sick, and the people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity." God is the one. God is the ultimate healer. The handouts that I gave to you give more passages about how God heals those who are bruised and sick, spiritually sick. And I think what Isaiah is saying here is that their ultimate need is not so much being delivered from their enemies. What their ultimate need is being delivered from sin, having forgiveness of their sins. That is what begs their attention. Their real need goes beyond being delivered from their enemies. And I would suggest for us as well that the trials and the hardships and difficulties we go through, we would be grateful to be delivered from those. Our ultimate need is to be delivered from sin, and God has made that possible through His Son. And so, if we find ourselves separated from God because of our sin, our ultimate need is finding forgiveness with God, and we have that because of what Jesus accomplished on our behalf. That is our greatest need above all. This section, this last section of Isaiah 34, verses 17 to 24. Any questions on that? Or thoughts that you have? Okay, let's continue on in chapters 34 and 35. Both chapters 34 and 35 are used together. It is a contrast we're going to see in chapter 34. It shows God's judgment upon the nation, showing that the Lord pours out His wrath on the nations who do not humble themselves before Him. And then chapter 35, we're going to see the redemption and the deliverance for God's people. And the way that it's described here, this judgment on the nations is described as a desert land that is completely desolate. We're going to see that in chapter 34. And then chapter 35, the picture is going to be of a beautiful garden that is blooming and producing things. What does that remind you of, a garden? But yeah, the Garden of Eden. And I think maybe that's what's going to be tapped into later on. But I think these chapters are a conclusion to what we've seen as God is His authority over the nations. And He continues to tap into this idea of God's wisdom and the folly of trusting in the nation. And we're going to find in verse 5 that Edom is specifically mentioned. And we'll go into this later on as we look at verse 5. But I think the idea here is that Edom represents everything that is opposed to God. Everything that is in contrast to God, that is hostile to God. They are the typical enemy of God. And that's what they represent. And we'll talk more about that when we get to verse 5. So let's look at chapter 34. The first four verses talk about this universal judgment. And so let's begin reading that. It says, "Draw near, O nations, to hear, and listen, O peoples. Let the earth and all it contains hear, and the world and all that springs from it. For the Lord's indignation is against all the nations, and his wrath against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter, so that their slain will be thrown out, and their corpses will give off their stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood, and all the host of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll, and all their hosts will wither away as a leaf withers from the vine, or as one withers from the fig tree." So these nations are called to listen and hear what God has to say. They are called to come together and listen to God. This call is not to witness God's mighty acts, but it is a call to judgment. It's a call to sentence, that they're going to be judged because they have failed to honor the Lord and give him the glory that he deserves. We've seen already that God is the great lawgiver. He gives this law. He is the one who extends mercy and forgiveness. But for those who reject God, the only thing that is left is judgment, because they failed to give him the proper preeminence and place in their lives that he deserves. And so his wrath is going to be poured out upon them. His indignation, his wrath, his anger is against all the nations and their armies. And he has utterly destroyed them. Did you notice in verse 2 how it looks to the past? You see that in verse 2 where he says, not that he's going to utterly destroy them, but that he has utterly destroyed them. And I think the point with that is, what God has planned and he's purposed is certain. That the things that God says he's going to do, he's going to accomplish. To the extent that he's able to speak about what has already taken place. And I think that's a really interesting thing in verse 2. There's a phrase here in verse 2 that he has utterly destroyed them. You see that phrase in verse 2 and in verse 5 as well, where he says about Edom that he has devoted them to destruction. So I've been learning a little bit of Hebrew with Curtis. He's taught me a little bit. And so I thought I'd use this as an opportunity to point out some of the things that really have been interesting to me. That you might not get just reading, but thinking about this Hebrew word. The Hebrew word here for destruction in verse 2, or destroyed in verse 2, and in verse 5, destruction, is the Hebrew word harum. I'm going to write it up here just to give you... I'll give it a shot. So Hebrew reads from right to left. This word is het. Resh. Probably not the best writing, and slant it a little bit, but those words compromise or they all add up to harum, can be translated that way. And it means to dedicate something or to put under a ban. And maybe your margin may have that. And that same, this word that's used in verse 2 and verse 5, to dedicate or put under a ban, it's also used in passages like Joshua chapter 6. Look at Joshua chapter 6.
Is it also used in Revelation?
Could be.
In chapter 9?
It could be. I'm not exactly sure. But chapter 6 in verse 21, this word is used in terms of God telling his people to utterly destroy the spoil of the nations. Look at Joshua chapter 6 verse 21 as it talks about destroying Jericho. It says, they utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. And then go over to 1 Samuel chapter 5 with me. 1 Samuel chapter 15. You see the same thing happening. 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 3. Where Saul was supposed to destroy all of the Amalekites. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 3. It says, now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. And so the point here is that this word means to utterly destroy, to put under a ban, to dedicate. And that was used for God's people to do that with the spoil of the nations. And what is being emphasized here in Isaiah 34 is that the nations are God's spoil. He has put them under a ban. He has dedicated them and devoted them to destruction. And that's what's going on. And I just thought that was a pretty cool comparison to look at those other ways that verse was used and how it's used here. But they are utterly destroyed. They're completely devoted to destruction. That is what's going on with these nations, because they fail to devote themselves to God. And not only that, in verse 3, we're told, adding to that defeat in their judgment, that the nations, the people are exposed. Their dead bodies are thrown out. Their corpses give off their stench. One of the most humiliating and shameful things for people in the ancient Near East was to be not given a proper burial. That was something that everybody wanted in the ancient Near East. And I think that's probably, that's something that we see is pretty important as well, to have a proper burial. I never have experienced this, but I would imagine it would be a pretty terrifying thing to have to see a body that's decomposing and smell the stench from the body. That is a terrifying thing to even think about. But that is just describing the kind of destruction that is happening to these people, that they're not even given a proper burial. And the next couple of verses mentions the mountains are drenched with their blood, the host of heaven wears away, the sky is rolled up like a scroll, the hosts wither away. And all of that is Day of the Lord language. It's all symbolic language. And it's not meant to be taken literally, but to show that God is the one who rules over all. Everything is in his hands. Can you imagine a slaughter so great that even the mountains are drenched with blood, that the mountains are filled with the blood of the slain? That is a terrifying sight to think about. But even going on here, that the sky is rolled up like a scroll, that God is over all, even the hosts of heaven, the skies are involved in that judgment. And that word, the sky being rolled up like a scroll, is mentioned in Revelation chapter 6, verses 10 through 12. So all of this, again, goes to show God's rule over these nations.
And their judgment. I was just going to say, Revelation 6, when you get into it, especially 13, just almost word for word of it. And
yeah.
It's been touched in some in Matthew 24.
Yeah.
So I just wondered if it was something that happened in the past also in war, or whether it was referring to the Revelation prediction. I'm not sure which way it's going.
Yeah. It may be that this has a immediate fulfillment in Isaiah's time frame, but an ultimate fulfillment in the Lord's return, perhaps. I'm not sure, but that's a good point. conversation. Thoughts on that or questions about that? Maybe I didn't point out. All right. Verses 5 through 8 is going to move from this general judgment, and it's going to talk about the nation of Edom. He mentions Edom as his concrete example, as the typical enemy of God. What do you know about the nation of Edom? What was their history with God's people?
Descended from Esau?
Yeah, descended from Esau.
Didn't allow the Israelites to go through when they were coming
yeah.
into the land.
Yeah. You see that in Numbers chapter 21, I think, or 20. What else about the nation of Edom do you remember?
In the southeastern part of the Dead Sea, so that we're not that far away.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
In the mountains.
Yeah, there is a mountainous range in Edom. They are mentioned in the book of Obadiah as taking part with the Babylonians to kind of destroy or, what's the word I'm looking for? They're contributing to Jerusalem's destruction in the book of Obadiah, doing all of these different things, treating them terribly. They're mentioned in so many other different books, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Amos, Malachi chapter 1, all shows the part, the enmity, the continual enmity that the people of Israel and Edom had together. And so I think what is being mentioned here, as he does mention Edom, is that they're just the typical enemy of God. They represent all of God's enemies. And that may be give us a better understanding of why they're singled out.
In 2 Samuel, though, King David made them captured a bunch of them and put them into slavery and everything. So that's one time they had
yeah.
that on, but that always been a thorn in the side.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a good way to put it, a thorn in their side. I think what Isaiah is saying here is that there's two ways. You can either choose Edom's way, and it's going to end terribly for you. It's going to end in this destruction. But if you choose God's way, chapter 35 will show the hope and the blessing that comes from choosing God's way. That's what awaits you. And so let's read verse 5 through 8. It says, "My sword is satiated in heaven. Behold, it shall descend for judgment upon Edom and upon the people whom I have devoted to destruction. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is sated with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozra, and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen will also fall with them, and young bulls with strong loins, and their land will be soaked with blood, and their dust become greasy with fat. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion." So this idea of the Lord's sword being satiated in heaven, what does that mean? Something being satiated, however you say it.
Filled.
It's filled up. Yeah, it's been filled up in the heavens, as you see in verse 4. But now this sword is going to come upon the nations, the people who have rebelled against him. He has devoted them to destruction. Really, kind of think about that for a moment. We are devoted to something in this life. We're either fully devoted to God and give Him everything that we have, or we're devoted to whatever else we want to devote ourselves to that only ends in destruction. And it's pointing out the importance of us being devoted to God. But this destruction of the nations is described as a sacrifice here. His sword is filled with blood. It is sated with fat. What do you think about the fat portion of the animal?
It's delicious.
It's delicious.
Yeah. It was used as a sacrifice.
Yeah, it was involved in sacrifice. You see that in Leviticus chapter 3. Regularly offered as a sacrifice. And that's the idea here. tapping into that Old Testament sacrificial imagery. He even says that in verse 6, that he has a sacrifice in Bozrah. Bozrah was one of the chief cities in Edom, I believe. And that's what's going on here, that taking place. And he says in verse 8, it is this day of vengeance, recompense for the cause of Zion. Everything that Edom has done to the nation of Israel is going to come back upon them. The Lord is bringing about his vengeance and his recompense upon them. So on Sunday morning, we'll pick back up in verse 9 and we'll cover the rest of the chapter. Are you teaching on Sunday? I will be in a gospel meeting on Sunday. So Johnny will begin covering that. Thank you for your thoughts and attention.
All these old bones up there. They're weird.